and his horns look devilish and cruel. I almost try to pull my hand free, to flee from him in terror. Then another shock reverberates through the house, rattling the ground. The windows at the far end of the passage explode in a storm of glass. Then the next window on, then the next, rippling down the passage straight toward us. I don't have time to scream. Erila scoops me up in his arms, holding me against his broad chest, and runs. I close my eyes, wishing I could close my ears as well to the sounds of shattering, breaking, and crushing that fill my head. I feel the sting of small missiles against my cheek. But Erilas receives the bulk of the blows. He bursts from the passage, out into the moonlit garden, just as the last windows shatter behind us. Even as the shock and roar fades, the ground continues to rumble underfoot. Erilas is panting, and I feel his heart pounding frantically under my hand. "Seven gods," he breathes. I pull back and look up into his face, covered in numerous cuts and gashes. More cuts lacerate his shoulders, and his garments hang in shreds as dark streams of blood roll down his skin. But he seems unaware of these wounds. He stares out across the sweeping view of the gardens, his eyes round with horror. I turn. I see what he sees. I hardly have words to describe it. The nightmare. So bizarre. So far beyond anything in my range of experience. Darkness looms over Orokin like a storm, obliterating starlight and moonlight. A great, living darkness. I see towers. Mighty citadels of stone that twist and writhe like living things. I see walls, arches, windows, buttresses, all vast on a scale beyond imagining, crawling straight for us, breaking through the far walls, swallowing the garden. "It's too late," Erilas says. I hear his words but can't comprehend them, can't make sense of them through the crazy tumult of my mind. "Her world will devour all of Orokin." Before I can even begin to ask any of the questions choking my throat, he whirls and heads back the way we came, still holding me fast. The walls of the windowed passage are listing heavily, and glass shards litter the ground in glittering, deadly profusion. I hear Erilas grunting, gasping with pain, as the glass slices into his feet. But he does not pause. He stumbles, rights himself, his grip around me tightening, and keeps on going. I want to ask him where we will go, where we possibly can go to escape from that nightmare vision. But I can't speak. My tongue is thick, numb with terror. We emerge into the courtyard. It's devastated, almost unrecognizable. Huge chunks of fallen masonry have smashed the stone floor and crushed the banqueting table to rubble. There is no way through. "Hold on," Erilas says. He leaps. I scream and tighten my grip around his neck as he achieves a precarious balance at the top of a massive stone block some 7 feet tall. He doesn't pause, doesn't hesitate even a moment before leaping again for another stone a good 8 feet across and a little down from us. Nimble as a cat, without even the benefit of his arms for balance, he navigates the destructive mayhem of the courtyard until he reaches a door at the far end. There, at last, he sets me down. I'm too dizzy at first to recognize where we've come. My legs feel like jelly, ready to give out under me, and I haven't yet managed to catch my breath. The air is full of dust, and my ears throb with the overwhelming roar of stone against stone as that darkness I glimpsed across the garden bears down upon Orokin. Erilas approaches the fastened door before us. It stands firm in its wall, unshaken by the quakes devastating the rest of the palace. It won't open. The latch refuses to turn, and when he pounds the panels, they echo hollowly. He hurls himself against it, his shoulder hitting the wood with a sickening thud. It rattles on its hinges, but nothing more. "No, no, no," he gasps, throwing his weight against it again and again. "Will even the gods abandon me?" I realize then where he's brought us. The chapel. The same chapel I've seen his shadow self seek for refuge, prostrating himself before the stone images of the gods. He had hoped we might shelter here through whatever storm is coming. I reach out, touch his arm. Aralas! At my touch and my voice, his whole body shudders, and he turns sharply, looking down at me. I shrink from the ferocity of his gaze, from the wicked curve of his horns, from the strange yellow, cat-like eyes shining down at me through the darkness. Then his expression melts into one of such sorrow it could break my heart.
I'll get you out of this, Valera. I swear it.
He takes my hand, and we're running together now, navigating the ruins of the colonnade. In places, the pillared roof is still upheld. In other places, he's obliged to lift me over the fallen stones or carry me across shattered roof tiles. I feel terrified, helpless, stupid with fear. I hate how useless I am. Useless to help either him or myself or anyone here in this moment. Where is Ellie? Where are Bergabog and the goblin men? What of the shadowy figures I've glimpsed through folds of reality? Are they also fleeing as their home falls to pieces around their ears? Or are Aralas and I alone? He reaches an open doorway leading to some part of the house I don't know. He pulls me swiftly through it, and I'm both surprised and relieved to find the passage beyond mostly intact. But I hear groans in the walls around me, and don't trust any of it to remain stable for long. Figures move in the shadows. Aralas stops abruptly. I run into him, then grip his arm and peer out from behind his bulk. A figure stands before us at the far end of the passage. A massive figure, humanoid in shape, but far bigger, broader than any man. As big as my husband. Bigger, even. An open window allows in a stream of moonlight, which lights upon great white wings.
Sunfire King, a voice speaks. A voice so heavenly, so majestic, it strikes the ears with all the solemn beauty of tolling cathedral bells. It rolls over me, over my spirit, and sends me to my knees.
Sunfire King, the voice says. Your bride awaits.
Aralas braces himself, stepping between me and that figure.
Stand aside, he snarls.
In contrast to that ethereal voice, he sounds like a ravening dog. It almost hurts my soul for his words to interrupt even the reverberating echoes of the winged one's utterance. The figure at the end of the passage adjusts his stance, wings widening to fill the whole space like a living gate.
I am come to escort you to your wedding, my king.
She, I can't say for certain which, merely that it is vast and powerful and majestic. Either way, it adjusts its stance, pointing the gleaming point of a lance straight at Aralas's heart.
Come, come and partake of the marriage feast.
Before the last word is complete, Aralas is in motion. He springs straight for the lance. For a heart-stopping moment of horror, I believe he will impale himself on it. But at the last moment, the winged one gives a cry, a golden, searing, beautiful cry, and yanks the deadly point out of his way so that the sharp edge merely grazes Aralas's shoulder. In another instant, Aralas's hands are around the winged one's neck. I hear a single, strangled cry, then a sickening crunch. The glorious being falls to the ground. Moonlight wafts gently against a face of heart-rending beauty. Stricken. Dead. Breath leaves my lips in a half-sob. What has just happened? What have I just witnessed? Did my husband murder an angel? With his bare hands?
Valera.
The sound of my name quickens the heart core to my chest, drags my gaze up from the fallen one to meet Aralas's eyes. He stares down at me with earnest entreaty.
Valera, please, They are not what they seem.
But... I can't think. I can't move. I can't...
My lord and king!
I start and whirl around, staring down the passages behind us. Three more heavenly beings approach, their wings flashing bright through the whirls of dust.
Come, Valera.
Aralas is beside me again, taking my hand.
This way.
I let myself be turned around. I let him drag me along behind him. My feet stagger, stumble, but he never slows his pace. The walls shudder, the ceilings shake, the floors tremble beneath us. The entire house will fall on top of us at any second. When I cast a glance behind, the dust is too thick to see if we are pursued. We arrive at a window. I blink, numb in body and soul, but realize after a moment that it is the same window I saw on my first day in Orokin, the one overlooking the waterfall and the great landscape bathed in moonlight. Aralas releases my hand and leans over the windowsill, then pulls his head back in and looks at me.
Do you think you are strong enough to hold on to my shoulders?
I recall that precipitous drop I witnessed once before and shudder. Then something seems to click into place inside my brain.
Wait,
I say, my voice breathless and choked with dust. What about this? I undo the clasp of one of my seven lockets. The wind garment pours out into my hand, invisible save for the silver buttons and my own small stitches. But its effects are unmistakable as it blows the dust away from us, clearing a little patch of breathable air.
What is this?
Aralas asks. Am I mistaken to believe I hear wonder in his voice?
What have you been up to, my clever wife?
I don't try to explain. I don the wind garment and feel its swelling power around me. Power enough to carry us both? I can only hope so. Hold on to me, I ask, stepping forward to stand beside him at the window. As long as you... I don't finish. I can't. For I've just looked out the window on that same moonlit landscape I glimpsed all those weeks ago. But it isn't the perilous empty spaces and vast distances that have stolen the words from my tongue. Wings fill the sky. Dozens upon dozens of wings. White, gleaming, moonlit wings, like a flock of doves, drawing nearer, nearer. I pause, one hand still fastening the topmost button of the wind garment, which swirls around me, frigid against my exposed skin. Aralas's arm comes down around my shoulder, his long fingers gripping hard.
Not that way, he says quietly. It was a good thought, but I fear we have only one option now.
They're close enough now that I can see their flashing armor, their helmets and cheek plates. I can see the burning of their heavenly eyes. Then Aralas's arm is shielding me, drawing me away from the window and back down the passage. I still wear the wind garment, which serves to clear away dust and debris, allowing us to breathe more easily as we flee. My eyes search beyond the radius of my personal windstorm for any glimpse of tall figures bearing lances, expecting them to appear and surround us at any moment. But we reach a large open space. I recognize it. The front entrance hall, with its domed ceiling and beautiful mosaic floor. The very place I last saw and spoke to my sister, when she pressed the candle into my hand. The candle, which was enchanted? My head spins, trying to make sense of it all. But I can't. There's too much. Too much. And the whole house quakes again with another terrible crash. Aralas leads me straight to the double doors. He stops a moment as the worst of the quake rolls under our feet, catching me close in his arms once more, pressing my face to his chest. When the roar of breaking stone passes, his voice rumbles in my ear.
This is not how I would have things end between us. The star glass was so much truer than I could ever have believed possible. I begged it to show me the face of my true love, and I saw you. I didn't believe it at the time. I thought something must have gone wrong. Thought the price I had paid for that single glimpse was not enough. Then I thought, what does it matter? If she weds me, if she becomes my bride, nothing else will matter. The Pale Queen will be unable to claim me before the time is past, and my people and I are safe.
Safe? I whisper in hollow echo. Safe from what? I feel his head shake, and for a moment, his arms tighten.
It doesn't matter now. It's too late. She has hounded me down, even as she did my brother, my father, my uncles. I thought to be clever, but I am not so clever as she. And now the hunt closes in.
I'm quivering so hard I can barely stand. My own ignorance plagues me with nameless, unknown fears. My arms cling to him. I want to hold him fast, to never let him go. If those winged beings are coming for us, to end us, I can only hope the end will be swift and that I will die while encircled in his arms. But Aralas steps back, holding my shoulders firmly as he puts distance between us. My wind billows his hair around his strange, striking face. He looks into my eyes, his expression unreadable, intent. Then he releases his grip on my shoulders and reaches instead for the silver buttons running down my bosom, holding the invisible garment in place. He undoes them one after another.
I knew you were talented, he says,
his fingers swift and sure.
I never imagined you capable of such a wonder. I believe you could do anything you set your will to with that passion, that drive of yours. You are truly powerful.
What? I feel so stupid, so small, not at all powerful. I can scarcely even comprehend what he is saying. Aralas! He presses a finger to my lips. Then he slides the wind garment off me. For a moment, as his fingers brush the skin of my neck, my traitorous body shivers in response to that touch, despite the fear, despite the horror of that moment. Oh, why did I throw away every chance I had to experience his touch to the fullest? Why did I not realize how little time we had? A year and a day had seemed so long. Now I would give anything for just one more hour.
Here,
he says, folding the wind garment and handing it to me.
Put this away. Do you still have the shadow cloth?
I nod, even as I hasten to obey. I hide the wind back in its locket, then open the locket containing the shadow, feeling the ripples of nothingness pour free. I can't even see it as it falls to the floor. But Aralas stoops and immediately snatches it up.
There,
he says, draping it around my shoulders.
This will serve. When you're through those doors, Valera, I want you to run. Run, run, run as far and as fast as you can. I wish I could take you all the way home. I hate breaking that promise to you now.
My stomach knots. After all, he'd broken that promise long ago. He broke it when he failed to tell me that time was passing and my sister was growing up by months, by years, while mere days passed for me. I open my mouth, wanting both to accuse and forgive in the same breath. But then he takes my face in his hands and I forget all else, lost in the depths of his golden-eyed gaze.
My valiant wife, he says. You could have saved us all. I do believe you would have in the end. But now,
he shakes his head.
Don't come after me. Forget me. Forget all of this. Return home and live in peace, for you are not to blame for what has happened here tonight. Indeed, you may be the only truly guiltless soul in this whole accursed world.
The house shakes again. Something crashes close by. Then a chunk of the ceiling falls and smashes into the floor just to my right. I scream, my voice lost in the noise, the mayhem. But Aralas takes a lunging step. One arm wraps protectively around my shoulders. The other reaches out, grabs the latch of the double doors and flings them wide. I stare out into a world of green, of daylight, utterly unlike the moonlit world in which I stand. For a moment, the strangeness of it is so great, so terrible, I can't even see it as the escape that it is. Then his voice is in my ear one last time.
Goodbye, Valera. I've loved you more than I ever believed it possible to love another living soul. May your life be full of joy.
Aralas! I cry. I try to turn, to catch sight of him. My hand reaches from beneath the shadow cloth, searching for his hand. But a great shove between my shoulders sends me staggering through the door and tumbling down the steps. I crash to my knees and feel the folds of the shadow fabric draping around me, covering me entirely. My ears are ripped apart by an ongoing roar, explosion after explosion, crashing glass and smashing stone, walls and towers crumbling. I curl up into a ball beneath the shadow cloth, my arms over my head, expecting Orokin itself to tumble down on top of me, crushing me in an avalanche of ruin. Other sounds fill my ears, a howling wail, dreadful laughter, a crash and clatter for which I have no name, like some massive engine tearing through the very layers of reality. Once I think I hear Aralas's voice, but perhaps I am imagining it. Then all is still. Terribly still. 29. Shivering so hard I fear my bones will shatter, I inhale deep, deep breaths. I'm alive. At least, I think I am. If this is death, it feels an awful lot like fear-ridden life. Maybe I've fallen deep into one of the 9 hells. Carefully, I reach out, feeling for the edges of my shadow fabric. I lift it tentatively and peer out from the darkness, expecting to see stone, rubble, ruin, and dust all around me. The devastation of Orokin fallen. Instead, I see brilliant morning sunlight shining on dew-glittering grass. With a gasp, I sit upright, casting the shadow cloth behind me like a cloak. I stare around, disbelieving. Where is the house? Where are the broken double doors, the smashed front porch step, the fallen domed ceiling? But it's gone. Just gone. Not ruins, but vanished, as though it never existed. I'm sitting in a green glade surrounded by tall, silent trees of silvery white birch. When I twist in place, I see nothing but forest, and more forest, extending forever on all sides. Of the palace, of the vast house and gardens, of Ellie and the goblin men, of Aralas, there is no sign. Clutching the folds of shadow cloth around my shoulders, I unsteadily rise to my feet. I feel like a child again, 7 years old and terrified, waking from a nightmare only to realize I cannot call out for my mother for comfort anymore. Because she's gone. Dead. That same feeling rushes over me. A wave of sorrow so deep, so overwhelming, I'm nearly crushed beneath it. I'm alone. Completely alone. Aralas, I whisper, turning in place. I wait for that connection between us to pull at my heart, as it always does when I speak his name. But there's nothing. It's as though the cord has been snapped completely. Aralas, I call again, my voice ringing through the trees. No answer. Only a distant echo. Then nothing at all. I take a step, stop, turn, and take a step in another direction. Which way can I go? It's all the same. Nothing but forest as far as the eye can see. How can I possibly find Aralas? Or home, or... My foot lands on something cold and metallic. I stop and look down, lifting my foot. It's my necklace. The clasp must have come undone when I fell, when Aralas pushed me through the door. The seven lockets gleam bright against the dirt, half hidden by curling bits of old leaves. Aralas's last gift. I pluck it up, winding the delicate chain through my fingers. For a moment, I bow my head, close my eyes. Tears and despair rise in my eyes and spirit, ready to overwhelm me completely, ready to wash all hope away in a flood I cannot resist. Aralas is gone. Those winged beings claimed him. For what purpose, I cannot imagine. Am I wrong in thinking they called him king? No, for the words still ring loud and clear in my memory. Sunfire King, that winged being had said. Your bride awaits. What bride? Was the being referring to me? No, it couldn't be. It made no sense. But who else could possibly be my husband's bride? I grip the necklace tighter, pressing it against my chest, my bare, heaving chest, so scantily clad in the little bit of nothing dress I wore in a bid to seduce and betray the kindest man I've ever known. The man who gave me such joy these last few weeks. The man who treated me with such respect, such kindness, such love. The man who'd lied to me? No. No, I don't believe it. I won't believe it. There is more going on here, more than I've even begun to understand. Something big and dark and terrible. Something great enough to swallow all of Orokin.
Don't come after me.
His words ring in my memory, almost the last words he spoke to me. Almost.
Don't come after me.
Does that mean it's possible? That I could go after him? That I could find him again? That I might yet unravel the secrets of this curse under which he and his people suffer?
You could have saved us all. I do believe you would have in the end.
I'm dizzy, almost sick from the emotion storming through my soul. Fear, sorrow, guilt, rage. But underscoring all is a grimness of determination unlike anything I've ever before known. I will find him, I whisper. I lift my head and look into the waiting, listening forest. Then I shout to the leaf-laced sky overhead. By the seven secret names, I swear I will find him. I will find him, and I will save him, and I will break this curse. My voice rolls away, its vain echoes fading, fading, gone. I listen until I can hear them no more. And when all is still once more, I whisper, I'm coming for you, Aralas. Wait for me. This is the end of Book 1, but the story continues with The Sunfire King, Book 2 of Candlelight and Shadows. Keep listening after the credits for a free preview. This has been a Podium Audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more swoon-worthy romance, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Reddit. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to The Moonfire Bride, Book 1 of Candlelight and Shadows. Associate Producer, Hannah Grenfell. Executive Producer, Emily Durr. Written by Sylvia Mercedes. Performed by Emily Lawrence, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Text copyright 2021 by Sylvia Mercedes. Production copyright 2021 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved. And now, a first look at The Sunfire King, Book 2 of Candlelight and Shadows. 1.
Valera.
My eyelashes flutter open. A vast pillared hall surrounds me, full of shadows so dense that I gain no clear sense of how big the space might be. It feels huge, cold. I tilt my head back to squint and stare, but can't so much as glimpse the ceiling overhead. I would be totally blind, but for the faint, flickering red glow of dozens of black filigree globes hung at intervals between the pillars.
Valera.
I turn in place, a frown creasing my brow. How did I come to be here? I've no memory of this place, and yet it feels oddly familiar. If I can force my eyes to open a little wider, to take in the light offered and make sense of the shadows, perhaps I might understand. Impending panic hums in my veins. I clench my fists and force it down. Panic will do me no good. I must be calm. I must try to remember. To remember.
Valera.
I turn sharply, peering into the dark space between the two pillars on my right. The harsh glow of the orb hanging there serves only to deepen surrounding shadows. Yet beyond it, I discern a door set deep into a black stone wall. Somehow, I know that whatever I'm looking for waits just beyond that door. For half a breath, I hesitate, even as longing surges through my spirit, urging me to leap. Fear pulls hard on the reins. I both desire and dread to find what? What inspires this powerful dichotomy of feeling?
Valera.
I'm coming, I whisper, though I can't say why. Gathering my courage, I step between the pillars, pass beneath the hovering globe, and approach the door. It's nearly twice my height and composed of many panels elegantly carved in a repeated motif of crowns and suns. My hand seeks a latch, finds it, applies a little pressure. It gives. The door swings silently inward. A magnificent chamber appears before me, more sumptuous than anything I could imagine. A huge fireplace dominates one wall, filled with that same red glow. Dozens of the filigree globes hang suspended from the domed ceiling, their chains of varied lengths producing the effect of a constellation of dying stars. Ornate furniture of black stone and crimson upholstery fills the space, arranged invitingly around the fire and the deep in-ground pool. Steam rises from the pool in aromatic vapors, and the waters froth invitingly. But the dominant feature in that space is the bed, a huge four-poster bed draped with a rich canopy of red curtains woven from some material I don't recognize, something vivid and shimmering, like liquid fire caught and woven into the finest threads. The curtains are drawn back to reveal a mattress piled with luxurious blankets and furs and plumped-up cushions. A figure lies on the bed, lounging in an attitude of total repose. Large, naked to the waist, his only covering a thin blanket of black silk draped casually across his loins. He reclines on the cushions, one arm languidly thrown back over his head. The orb's light gleams on his dusky skin, accentuating the muscle definition of his torso, glinting from the dark coils of his horns. My breath catches. I know that face, so fierce, so beautiful, so terrifying. I've glimpsed it by the furtive glow of my candle, and I will never forget that sight. My skin burns with the memory of those long-fingered, claw-tipped hands as they caressed my trembling body in the darkness. So frightening, and yet so gentle, careful not to hurt my tender flesh. I shiver where I stand, my mouth suddenly dry, my pulse thudding in my temples. I want more, more of that touch, more of those flirtations with danger and delight. Hardly aware of what I'm doing, fire simmering in my gut, I take a step into the room, toward that bed. His eyes open. Though he remains on those pillows, his gaze darts across the room and fixes on my face for an instant before gliding away. His brow hardens, and he starts to sit up. A clink of chains pulls him back down. Something is wrong. Like an image in a trick mirror, the scene before me alters. Or rather, my perception shifts, becoming aware of a reality that has been there all along, but which my eyes overlooked until that moment. He still lies sprawled across the bed, but he no longer looks relaxed or seductive. I see strain in his face, in the lines of his body. His eyes close again, not in sleep, but as though he seeks to escape great pain. I stand frozen as memories pound my mind, memories of candlelight and betrayal, of shadows and white wings, of shattered glass and screams and terror. I did this. I did this to him. Carefully, I enter the room and pull the door shut. My bare feet make no sound on the stone floor as I approach the bed. He doesn't stir, seems unaware of my approach. Manacles clutch his wrists, and chain links secure him to the tall bedposts. Sweat gleams on his skin, reflecting the glow of the orbs. His cheeks are hollow, his eyes sunken into his skull. I step nearer. Now I see the welts lacing his skin, the dark bruises swelling his beautiful face. A storm of emotions churns in my breast. Horror at the cruelty, shame at his nakedness, pity for his pain, and rage. Dark, roiling, terrible rage rises from the core of my being, flooding through every sense. Rage so powerful, so intense, it hardly seems possible it can belong to me. It frightens me, but I don't shy away from the feeling. I need it. My hand reaches out, hovers over his battered cheek. I rest my fingers lightly against his skin. His eyes flare open and he surges up, straining at his chains, turning this way and that, his lips curled back from sharp white teeth. But his gaze cannot find my face. I'm invisible to him. This is a dream. Tears fill my eyes, even as despair weighs my heart. If this is a dream, then I haven't found him yet. Not truly. Wherever he is, he's still far from me, beyond my reach to comfort or help. "I'm here," I whisper, my voice quavering as it speaks what I now know is a lie. "Can you hear me?" He can't. Nostrils flaring, he continues to stare around the room like a stag sniffing the air for some telltale scent of the hunter. "Please," I persist, taking a step closer to that bed. "Aralos!" As his name leaves my lips, something in the air sparks, something like a taut thread suspended between us. The tug of it makes me gasp. He reacts as well, staring down at his bare chest. He lifts one hand, chains clinking, and places his palm over his heart. My hopes lift. He must know I'm nearby. "Aralos," I say again, reaching for that connection and pulling it gently, carefully, afraid it will snap. "Aralos, it's me. I'm here. I'm close. I will find you and free you, I swear. But first, can you tell me where you are?" He looks up slowly. His eyes, strange yellow eyes, like a cat's with hugely dilated black pupils, seek me in the empty spaces, but cannot rest on my face. Instead, they stare off into the shadows over my shoulder. His lips move. I think he forms my name.
Valera.
The door to the chamber slams open, hitting the wall. I scream, whirl in place, and throw up both hands. Huge figures stream into the room, mighty beings with faces that look as though they've been carved from living marble. Great wings spread at their backs, and their hands grip gold-shafted lances. They part, forming two lines on either side of the door. Another figure appears, framed in the doorway. A woman taller than the winged ones, taller than any man. Her skin is as pale as ivory. Her hair is like a great white cloud, massed in coils atop her head and hanging in ringlets down her back. She has no wings, but moves with a grace and power that is nonetheless angelic. A long crimson gown clings to her figure, its neckline plunging deeply between her pale breasts. A black band encircles her long neck, and suspended from this band, resting in the hollow of her throat, is a brilliant red stone that burns with its own inner fire, illuminating the lower half of her face in a hellish glow. Her blood-red lips peel away from her teeth in a snarl as she points one long, claw-tipped finger straight at me.
"I know you're there," she cries. "Begone, phantom! He's mine! By the laws of claiming and choosing, you have no right to him now!"
The stone blazes brighter until it seems to engulf the woman in flames. A blast of pure energy bursts from her finger, and the whole world fills with light, with heat, with melting pain. 2. I wake with a gasp. Am I burning? Is my skin blistered, peeling away from flesh and bone? For an instant, only an instant, I feel it all with excruciating clarity. The instant passes. I lie still, my heart thudding. Reason and awareness slowly creep in along the edges of my mind. 7 gods above, where am I? This isn't my lumpy mattress back home. A blanket seems to be pulled over my head, but it isn't my patchwork quilt sewn out of remnants from Mistress Petrin's shop. I tentatively grip a fold of the fabric. It's softer than velvet, finer than silk, slipping through my fingers like a shadow. Memories flood in fast now. I'm not at home. I'm as far from home as it's possible to be. In another world entirely. Taken by the Fae. Stolen away to become a moonfire bride. Aralas. I groan and shut my eyes. But it's no use. I can't shut out the image in my mind of my husband's face bathed in candlelight. I can't unsee the look in his eye, the flash of both understanding and betrayal. I've ruined everything. I gave in to my fears, gave in to temptation, and now he's gone. For a little while, I let the tide of self-reproach overwhelm me, drag me into its depths. But slowly, other senses creep back in. My stomach is hollow, for one thing, cavernously hollow, and something hard and knotted jabs painfully against one of my ribs. When I look around again, filmy darkness obscures my vision like a veil. I peer through it and see leafy branches overhead, revealing only small patches of distant sky. I know then that this darkness truly is what I thought. Shadow. Shadow captured by magic and spun into thread, woven into a cloth fine and soft, yet more durable than canvas. Once more, I close my eyes as another storm of memories batters my mind. I see again the indistinct form of my husband standing in the domed front hall of Orokin Palace, even as the walls shudder and the ceiling breaks. He wrapped his shadow cloth around my shoulders and told me not to look for him, to forget him. Then he pushed me out the door into the greenness and warmth of whispering wood and... what? Was he crushed beneath the ruins of the palace as it caved in on itself? No, that can't be the truth. I draw a long, careful breath. Then I sit up slowly, pushing back the shadow cloth so that it falls around my shoulders. It serves well as a deflection, rendering me practically invisible to the naked eye. I have been wearing the fabric like a cloak as I march through the forest, searching for some sign of a path, some indication of civilization. A few times I thought I glimpsed creatures through the trees, strange creatures that I never saw clearly enough to recognize. Each time I pulled the shadow up over my head, pressed my back against a tree trunk, and waited until whatever it was had passed by. Once my heart settled back into a steady rhythm, I continued on my way. That was, what? Hours ago now. Maybe days. Maybe weeks. Who can say how time passes in a place like a whispering wood? I'd finally come upon an oak tree. Somewhere in the back of my brain, I seem to remember my sister telling me that oaks are friendly to humans. That if ever a human became lost in the wood, an oak tree would offer shelter. Brielle spent an inordinate amount of time in Whispering Wood, even as a child. She seemed to know what she was talking about. So, exhausted, footsore, on the verge of collapse, I'd decided to risk it. I curled up underneath the oak tree, pulled the shadow up over my head, and fell into an uneasy sleep. And there must be something to Brielle's theory, since I'm still alive after my nap. Alive and at least somewhat rested. I look up at the oak above me. Thank you, I say softly. A gentle breeze stirs the branches, which whisper, shush, and then go still again. Pulling bits of leaf and sticks from my hair, I slowly look around. The oak's branches spread over me like a protective canopy, beyond which stands the endless wood. My brow puckers in a frown. Maybe I'm simply misremembering. Maybe when I lay down, I was too tired to take note of my surroundings. But I'm fairly certain that when I fell asleep, there was no stream flowing close by. There's a stream now, just off to my right, bright and babbling, a little too wide to jump across. A convenient set of stepping stones provides a bridge. The flat surfaces cushioned with soft moss practically invite sore, bare feet to step on them. Young willows along the opposite bank trail long boughs in the water, their leaves forming a natural curtain. Something about those willows is unsettling. Anything might lurk behind those branches, and the stream and the stones. The whole tableau feels wrong, like a trap. I lean against the trunk at my back, seeking comfort. My senses can't be as attuned to the life of the wood as Brielle's. I discern no particular sense of safety or protection, just a tree. Still, I slept in Whispering Wood and survived. That must count for something. I close my eyes and lean my head back against the bark. Fleeting images fill my mind. Mere glimpses, impressions. Globes of red light shining down on a dark figure caught in chains. There a moment, then gone. My stomach growls. I grimace, eyes popping open, and place a hand over my hollow midsection. Gods above, I'm hungry. And thirsty. Terribly thirsty. My throat is parched. My tongue is dry as a block of wood. I try to moisten my lips, but can't. Beside me, the stream trickles, gurgles. So tempting. No,
What does this God's blasted forest take me for? I might not possess my sister's woodcraft, but I'm not an idiot. I know a trap when I see one. Narrowing my eyes, I peer at the curtain of willow branches, trying to see into the shadows beyond. Survival instinct prickles my awareness, a subtle warning. Something is there, I'm sure of it. Something dark, toothy, and long-fingered. Something not quite brave enough to show itself, just waiting for me to crouch on the edge of the stream, to lower my face to the water. "Sorry to disappoint," I growl, my voice rough in my dry throat. Using the oak for support, I stand slowly, swaying a little, unsteady on my feet. The wind stirs again, tugging at the folds of shadow cloth around me. I grip it hard to keep it in place. Then I frown and look down at myself under the dark folds. Gods above, have mercy. I'm still wearing the bit of white, flimsy nothing I donned last night. Or was it last night? It might be 100 years ago, for all I can guess. Regardless, this certainly isn't a gown suited for tramping through a forest. Lacking sensible buttons or laces, it wraps my body and ties at the hip, leaving a deep V across my bosom and a long slit up my thigh. It's a gown intended for darkness and whispers, for kisses and caresses. Heat flares up my face. I press a hand against my cheek, groaning softly. What a fool I've been. Oh, such a fool. Why did I listen to Brielle? Why did I take that candle and break my husband's trust? He asked so little of me, only that I not try to see his face. But it's all so twisted, so sordid. Which one do I believe? The shadowy bridegroom who stole me from my father's house but won my heart with his kindness? The beloved sister who moved heaven and earth to find me, to save me from the snare of a fey captor? The unseen speaker on the far side of Orokin's front door, warning me of monster lovers with vicious lusts and appetites? How am I to know who to trust? My hand slips from my face down my neck to rest on the golden chain and the 7 lockets lying against my exposed bosom. Aralos's gift. His final gift. He'd wanted so much to please me. When his initial offerings of gowns and jewels failed to meet this goal, he'd tried again. He'd observed me, studied me, taken the time to learn who I am, what I love. He'd seen that my truest joy stems from creativity, from working with my hands with needle and thread, from making beautiful gowns. Not for myself. I have no need of elegant garments. Simply for the pleasure of creating them. So he'd given me this necklace, each locket of which contains a special fabric woven of the most unusual textiles. Cloth spun of shadow and sunlight, fire and wind, and other strange and glorious threads. A smile tugs at the corner of my mouth, even as a single tear escapes through my lashes and runs down my cheek. No one has ever tried to know me. Not like Aralos did. To understand me, too.
I loved you more than I ever believed it possible to love another living soul.
His voice, racked with pain, with fear, with sorrow, whispers softly through my memory. He loves me. I know that now. If I'm honest with myself, I've known for some time. He demonstrated his love for me again and again, but I was too stubborn to recognize it. If only I'd chosen to accept it, to rest in the truth of his love. It would have been enough for both of us. My brow tightens suddenly as my fingers touch the center locket of the necklace. I feel the little engraving in the bright gold, swirling lines like a blowing wind. I look down at the locket, turning it gently. Then I lift my gaze to peer through the canopy of oak leaves overhead. My lips press together in a tight line. If I can get up above the trees,
Will I be able to spy the edge of the forest in the distance? Better still, might I be able to fly free of the woods entirely? My heart beats faster, thudding in my ears. It's a dangerous idea, and probably stupid. One wrong move could spell disaster and death. But what better choice do I have? Continue wandering in Whispering Wood until I collapse from sheer exhaustion and die, leaving my skeleton as a rotting example to unwary travelers? No, I won't give up so easily. Setting my jaw, I swing the shadow cloth away from my shoulders, fold it quickly, and open one of the 7 lockets. Though the locket isn't large, the cloth folds smaller and smaller until it neatly fits inside. I fasten the clasp, then select the center locket of the 7. All right, I whisper, balancing on the balls of my feet. All right, get ready. I flick the locket open. A blast of wind bursts from inside, straight into my face. I yelp and fall back several paces, nearly knocked off my feet. A flicker of silver buttons draws my eye, and on reflex, I throw out a hand. My fingers close around a button and a handful of invisible, billowing fabric. My cloth of wind. It ripples in my grasp, dragging my arm to and fro in its efforts to escape. I hold on, and my other hand catches as well, pulling the wind toward me. For a moment, it resists. Then, like a wild pony realizing it cannot shake free of the reins, it gives in. It slumps so suddenly that my arms drop, and I almost lose my hold. Carefully adjusting my grip, I hold up the invisible cloth, which I just days ago fashioned into a vest. Its only visible details are the tiny, somewhat erratic stitches at the seams and the row of silver buttons running up the front. Each button is larger than the locket in which the garment was contained. Not one of them should have fit inside. But such physical limitations don't seem to matter where this magic is concerned. I give the vest a shake. I've tried it on only once before. With goblin men hanging on to the end of a rope attached to the back of the garment, I'd taken an experimental flight. But when they lost their hold, I'd risen high above the rooftops of Orokin. The experience had been simultaneously terrifying and thrilling, and utterly breathtaking. In the end, I managed to control the wind I wore and return safely to the ground. Surely I can manage again. I shrug into the vest and hastily fasten the row of 8 buttons. The breeze flutters around me, gentle and soft for the moment, though I know better than to trust it. I thoughtfully study the little clearing. Last time, I jumped from a slanted rooftop in my efforts to get airborne. There's no roof here, but one of the oak's branches sweeps out over the stream. I eye the stream, so bright and peaceful. Its mossy banks are soft and inviting. How deep is the water? It's impossible to tell from where I stand. Deep, though. Deeper than it looks, I'm willing to bet. Backing away from the stream, I peer into the forest beyond the oak tree's canopy. The trees here are mostly conifers, their needles thickly interlaced, their branches hanging low. Sunlight finds its way through to dapple the ground in places, but otherwise, all is dark as night. Nowhere to climb, not while barefoot and wearing this scanty little nothing of a gown. I take a deep breath, then spread my arms, letting the loose flaps of cloth hanging there open like sails. The wind surrounding me increases, billowing my loose hair up around my face in a dark cloud. It wants to lift me, but I need height and momentum. I take a running start and leap. For half a second, the breeze rushes beneath me, bearing me up like a soft cushion of air. But I come back down again, hard. My legs buckle. I stumble, fall, and land on my hands and knees. For several heartbeats, I stare down at the ground between my fingers, panting. Then I rise, rubbing my stinging palms on my hips. Dirt and blood smear the soft white fabric of my gown. My little running leap brought me right to the edge of the oak tree's shelter. I back up again quickly, closer to the trunk. Three more times, I try to run and jump into the air. Three more times, I think I might succeed. Think the wind might swell and lift me higher. Three more times, I crash back to the earth before I've risen more than a foot or two. My gaze returns to the oak bough extended over the stream. The water flowing beneath burbles sweetly, disarmingly. If I jump and the wind doesn't bear me up, I'll fall into that water. And what will I find waiting just beneath the surface? I can almost feel slimy, long-fingered hands latch hold of my ankle, my calf, dragging me down, down, down. I close my eyes, giving my head a vicious shake. No good can come of letting my imagination run wild. I must try. I must. "So get on with it," I growl. Brielle was always the tree climber and adventurer of the two of us. I have little experience at scaling a trunk or shifting my weight from branch to branch, particularly not while barefoot and wearing next to nothing. But I manage it somehow. While the bough waves and bobs under my weight and my stomach swims with dread, I sidle out further and further over the stream. Rough bark scrapes my bare legs and feet. The white gown catches on a twig, its soft fabric straining. I hear one long rip. "Seven gods preserve me," I whisper, rolling my eyes heavenward. And I keep going. When I'm out over the water, I stare down, trying to force my eyes to see what lies beneath the surface. Is that a face peering back up at me? Or merely my own reflection? It blinks when I blink, tilts its head when I tilt my head. But I don't quite believe it. It's too good a lie. Very well. I can't fall. I won't fall. It's as simple as that. Limbs shaking, I lift my gaze to the clear sky above, framed by oak leaves and pine boughs. The wind surrounding me pulls eagerly, like a promise. Is it a promise I can trust? Cautiously, using my hands for balance, I stand upright on the bough. It sags slightly under my weight, but not as much as I expected. I touch the necklace one last time, the bright lockets cold under my fingertips. For an instant, I see an image in my mind's eye, a pair of bright, golden eyes staring up at me from a dark, fine-boned face. Then, taking hold of my courage with both hands, I leap. For an instant, I hang weightless in the air, poised like a star, neither rising nor falling. For an instant, I think I feel the wind swell beneath me, think I feel it bearing me up. The instant passes. I begin to sink.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.